Welcome to Vase, a podcast about weird stuff. I'm Peter C. Hine.
And I am Stephen James Buckley.
And tonight we are incredibly privileged to be joined by a musician, a drum teacher, a hypnotherapist, a cognitive behavioral therapist, author, Satanist, chaos magician, who holds workshops and lectures in association with the world famous occult bookstore Treadwell's in London. This is Mr. Mark Vincent.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you doing?
Very, very well, thank you.
I like the way you slipped the Satanist bit in. We'll get to that in a while, shall we?
That was to check if people were listening or not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now they are.
I thought it was they were all separate people.
Well, maybe they are. You'll find out.
So that's a lot of hats, though. Like Buckley would say, that is a lot. I mean, that could well be sort of 12 different people. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you find the time for all that?
That's a good question. I have a coach now to sort of stop me having what I call idea explosions. So I've always been self-employed, and kind of about 2008 sort of joined a business networking group and got into this. I have this kind of mode of working where I just think of things and I try them out and I see what works. I know that sounds suitable. So at the moment I'm meeting with a tarot reader from Treadwell's about a possible collaboration in future. So I just kind of put my tendrils out and see what happens. And it, you know, I just kind of let things reveal themselves. I said, God, that sounds pretentious, doesn't it? But it's just great. How I've worked for so long. You know, the most kind of normal business thing I do is the teaching. So that's kind of the most structured. And then the rest of it, I just kind of meet with interesting people, do things like this, and kind of work comes out of it.
You teach at Treadwell's as well as the magical courses, and that's where I'd met you. Yeah. And a little bit of background for our listeners, you're the author of The Sigil Secret, which is where I'd first sort of come across your work. Mark's got his copy. I've got my copy on hand as well.
Oh, excellent. Good.
And that's a book containing, amongst other things, probably the most comprehensive and easy to follow system for arriving at the correct intention for a sigil that you want to create that I've ever read. And so I took one of your workshops at Treadwell's. It was a two-part weekend workshop, sigils, servitors, and possession states. And it was truly excellent. I'd encourage anyone to do it because, as well as being really interesting and obviously an engaging course about the magical principles, as corny as this sound, I honestly feel like I learned a bit more about myself too, because it was kind of like a very deeply introspective and very, very proactive course. And I loved every minute of it. Are you still teaching that one now?
We're running it again in the summer next year. So that was the first time I'd ever run that one. I had that concept in my head for a long time, that particular course. And what I wanted to do was have 2 days with a group of people to smash their belief systems to pieces. No, but really kind of take time. So the essence to me of occult practice and magic is getting to what you're really after, right? And so I try to work from the inside out. One of the things I get people to do is write down the ideal version of themselves. It's going to sound awfully naff, but it's actually borrowed it from the chimp paradox. And the surprise, I suppose, is that when you do that and you tell somebody, well, that is you, when all your animal brain is out of the way, that is you. It's already there. You are already that person. And once the kind of ripples of shock have gone through the room, then you can kind of get them to work on, okay, well, what are the three most important ones? Because actually everything people do in day-to-day life is trying to realize those things about themselves in some way or another. And I think in, you know, the diagram I used, I don't even remember how I came up with it. I just kind of sat noodling it and then I gave it to my wife and said, can you make this look nice, please? But I wanted something. One of the things I really like about occult practice is it's quite cool and it's interesting and creative. So you can do some really kind of tricky work that would normally be quite a grind and make it a bit more creative and inspiring, I suppose. And that's kind of what I was after with
it. Everyone who was on the course, I think, got something out of it as well, which is, I think, kind of one of the main tenets of chaos magic, isn't it? It's results-based magic.
I wanted to say I'm really glad you sort of like the statement of intent system in the book, because that was kind of my reason for wanting to write it. Because the book actually came about by accident. I've been running courses for Treadwells for about 10 years. And then just before the pandemic, so what year was the pandemic? 2020. Right, thanks. So must have been 2019. Towards the end of 2019, I ran the course and then we went for drinks in the pub afterwards. I just like to hang out with my students if I get time. And literally just as I was leaving, this woman came up behind me and said, "No, don't go. Have you thought of turning this into a book?" And just went from there. That was Edith from Palasia. And so that's kind of how that came about. But I'd always wanted to, it bugs me in occult practice that there's a lot of flouncing around and ceremony and drawing of things and candles and chanting, but there's not enough talking about why you're doing it. There's too much method, not enough concept.
And that is the central thing of chaos magic, isn't it? To strip it back to that which truly works. And we're really glad to finally have a chance to properly talk about chaos magic, because we've had a few goes at it ourselves, as in talking about it. I've seen the last few months since starting this podcast, that started in tandem with me starting my own chaos magic practice. Loosely, I would call it chaos magic. Sure. So we have knocked about a few ideas about chaos magic, and we've talked about sigils a little bit, and we talked a little bit about the history of chaos magic, but we really, really want to get sort of deep into it today. And so we're really glad to have someone who's a proper practicing chaos magic. How long have you been practicing for now?
Too long. with chaos magic, I mean, chaos magic is to me, it's just a way of thinking about the universe. So thinking about how things work. But so I suppose sigils, let's say at least 15 years on and off. And I'm not doing them every day. I have periods where I don't touch it. I started with some dodgy witchcraft books from the library. And then I practiced a really, really hybrid version of Santeria. South American voodoo. And I had some interesting experiences with that and frightened myself quite a lot, and kind of danced around. So I bought the Satanic Bible, tried some of that stuff. And I couldn't really tell you where I came across chaos magic. I can't remember. It was such a long time ago. At least 15 years, I guess. And the reason I like it is because, I use what I could be referred to as the psychological model of magic. So I think it's all up here, and we'll get into that, and we can go way down the rabbit hole with that if you like.
I'm looking forward to that.
I have some recommendations of things to read and people to check out who are not occultists, who are like neuroscientists and physicists. And so there's an interesting, it's just an interesting crossover, and the kind of, what are you trying to get to question is pertinent in therapy and in chaos magic. So it just kind of does this for me. It's all, everything I do is kind of around, like, I don't like grinding metal. I don't like doing things for no reason. It's not that I don't like doing things for no reason. I don't like spinning my wheels on anything. I like to have a purpose behind it. Otherwise I just get bored and drift off and don't do very much. Playing the drums to me is an act of chaos magic anyway. It's an act of magic. You're sort of producing an effect, and it doesn't require anything. So also magic doesn't require, so if you're taking Crowley's version that you're just imposing your will on the universe, playing an instrument is an act of control. So there, and there's several, it's very good for you on lots of different levels, regardless of whether you think the sounds are doing anything esoteric. It's just, you know, and ritual, this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently. This idea of the necessity of ritual. So it's kind of how I can hold both positions, quite a rational position on a lot of things, and then on other positions seem quite abstract and irrational, because I think just the act of doing a magic ritual is quite good for your limbic system and your unconscious. because it needs it. It gives you a certain amount of certainty. So you can kind of engage with, it's why religion exists, right? You know, we have no idea why the hell we're here, really. And there's a bit of your brain that's an animal that's sitting there going, my God, what the hell's going on? And if you can give it some kind of certainty, it's very good for it. And sort of ritual space is very good for that. You know, I go to like open rituals, like if a Wiccan group is holding in London, I just go for fun, you know, just to sort of do it rather than, it doesn't sort of have to have any big kind of end game. So there you go.
So you talked about the idea of it being all in our heads, mm-hmm. magic, chaos magic, yeah. etc.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's examples of what could be called chaos magic that are, or at least something operating by similar principles that are happening in the world around us, for example, in politics or advertising?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Yeah.
So chaos magic is simply the idea that your beliefs affect the world.
Yeah.
Right? How directly you think that's the case is kind of up to you. I have sort of a particular position on it at the, so I hold positions. I don't believe anything. I just sort of have places I'm in at the moment. And if I hear something new, I try and move, or I just dig my heels in and jump up and down and scream. It depends on what day it is. But yeah, like, well, marketing is chaos magic. That's exactly what it is. It's what you're doing. You're emotionally influencing people through the use of symbols. I mean, Christ, the Nike tick is a sigil. McDonald's, welcome. The Starbucks mermaid, all of these things are sigils. And this is the thing I think that sort of can be tricky for people to get their heads around to start with, is that most of magical work is actually quite mundane. Right, and a lot of it you wouldn't necessarily call magic. It's just, I call it that because that's how I look at things. But yeah, marketing is absolute. That's what you're doing. You are influencing people.
And there's a few prominent chaos magicians, isn't there, who are who worked in advertising, like Gordon White did, and I think Jason Louvre did as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not the most well-read occultist, shall we say. I didn't even read my own book for a little while. Like, it was kind of, I've written it, get it out there. But yeah, the symbols have an effect. And it comes back to this sort of idea of, when people are talking about magic, they want some kind of proof that something real is happening, right? Do you mind if I kind of lead you down a pathway a little bit here?
Please do.
Okay, cool. All right. And this is going to come off symbols, so if you want to drag me back, do so. So my biggest interest at the moment, therapeutically, is long-term persistent pain. And the reason for my interest in it is because it has very... Well, because I had chronic pain myself for a couple of years. But also there is a very strong crossover with chaos magic. So... One of the questions, I work with fibromyalgia patients quite a lot, right? And I don't cure fibromyalgia, so it's not a thing to be cured. And also, if anybody's listening to this, go to your doctor first before you do anything else. So pain is a belief system in your brain. That's the first thing to understand. And this... the first kind of instance of this being acknowledged was by a guy called John Sarno, who wrote a book called Curing Back Pain, and it was written in 1950-something. And he used to cure long-term back pain using psychology. And his hypothesis was that it's basically stored emotion in the body. Now, these are things you will have come across, right?
Yeah.
But it turns out it's true. And it's more than just a bit true. So we have a modern model of pain called the biopsychosocial model. So the reason you hurt when anything happens is the physical injury, your mood, and the social influences on you, right? So you might have heard this, Peter, but I'm going to ask you, Stephen. You've heard of a slip disc in the back?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think is a percentage, the correlation between having a slip disc and being in pain is?
I have absolutely no idea. So I'm just going to say 50%.
It's about zero.
Right, okay.
Give or take, right? So so if you take a large sample of people, the chances are you have both got disc herniations.
Right, okay.
Right now you're going to start checking, right?
Yeah.
So and that doesn't mean that they don't cause pain, but it means across a large sample, the correlation is nothing, is zero. So wow. It turns out, which is why when people have MRI scans, the MRI scan doesn't necessarily show what's causing the pain, right? It might show that there's structural problems, but that doesn't correlate with what the pain is. Is that clear so far? So the physical injury and the act of hurting are not the same,
yeah.
Right? So it turns out, I'll keep this reasonably short, that the reason you hurt is because when damage is perceived, and that's key, your unconscious, so your limbic system, makes a judgment on how bad it thinks the injury might be and how badly it needs to stop you doing something. So pain isn't a sign that you're damaged. It's a warning sign to stop you doing something that might make it worse. Okay? So one of the biggest modulators is your mood, right? So if you're in a shit mood, you hurt more. Now, everybody kind of knows this, right? But one of the biggest correlators of how badly you hurt after an operation is how stressed you are about it in the first place. So your brain flags it up as dangerous. You have it, you come out and you hurt because it assumes it's dangerous, right? So my mum and my dad both had the same hip operation. My mum had no pain at all. My dad was in agony. Which one of my parents is more stressed, right?
Yeah,
So it's and on top of that, you have social reinforcers, right? So one of my hobbies is powerlifting, and I have a coach in the States that I work with. And the best people to talk to if you hurt your back are professional powerlifters, because they understand more about the psychological influence on back pain. So most back pain that you get is completely harmless. It's just that you have had the idea communicated to you via osmosis your entire life that your back is quite fragile, right? Also, there's a lot of nerves running down there, so your brain unconsciously analyzes it, looks at it and goes, what does it mean if my back hurts, right? And what do most people do when they get pain? They go on Google and they look, and then they see all the worst things it could be, and their limbic system goes, oh my God, this is dangerous. And you get pain. So pain is a belief system. And it's a complicated belief system. So you are, whenever you hurt, you are experiencing chaos magic. You're experiencing a belief shift. And the way for example, with things like fibromyalgia, one of the things that I do is explain to the person that the pain doesn't mean they're damaged. Right? So this assumption that because you're hurt, there must be inflammation and all these other things. Once they let go of the idea that moving is going to hurt them, they start to calm down. When they calm down, the pain drops. Now, I'm not saying there's no physical component to it, but the word itself sounds terrifying, right? It's like if I say to you, you've got, I don't know, chronic disc degeneration and spinal stenosis, your brain goes, oh my God, what is that? Right? And there's a very good, there's a guy on Instagram I follow called Tactical Fit. There's a group of physios now who are kind of pushing this thing forwards, physicians and people working with people who are injured should be careful how they talk about injuries, right? So if I tell you you have got, stage 3 chronic inflammatory tendinopathy in your left femur, your brain is going to go, holy shit, you're going to get frightened and it's going to hurt more. Whereas if I say you've tweaked your knee, you know, right? It's a belief system, and that's not to say, it's not saying there's no physical component. It's just that the physical component is smaller than you think it is to the amount of pain that you're in. Thank you.
when you're working with these patients who are experiencing this chronic pain, are you using, you were saying that their belief system is what is influencing to an extent the pain that they're feeling.
It's not helping, put it that way.
Right, and that is like a bit of chaos magic itself, you know, because their belief system is reinforcing this idea that they're in pain. Do you use chaos magic methods to help to get rid of that pain?
No, not in a therapeutic setting, no. I explain to them that the biggest thing I have seen across the board is explaining that the pain doesn't mean you're damaged. There's a few articles I can send you after this to read, written by physios. And so you can put it in with the podcast. So you can see it's not just me making this up. There's a lot of evidence around this stuff. But essentially, if I explain to them that they are not, the pain doesn't mean they're damaged, that tends to do a lot of the work. You can physically see people go, oh, okay. It's not, and then they say, well, what's real pain? So this comes back to this magic idea of what is real and what isn't, right? So what is real? What is real pain? What they really mean by it, what they really mean is how badly injured am I, right? Because pain is created by the brain, whatever happens. So you can have a really bad injury and a lot of pain, or no injury and a lot of pain. They're not as linked as you think they are. And this is the key: is that you think that because you hurt, it means you're damaged, and it doesn't. The best quote I heard about it was that pain is complicated, rehabilitation simple, right? So the reasons you're experiencing are loads, right? Actually, most tissue injuries heal after 6 weeks. After 3 months, almost all injuries, including tendons, heal, right? Anything after that, any pain that resides over 6 weeks is a misfiring of the system. So it's an assumption. And this is why you can get people who say, oh, I slipped my disc, I slipped a disc in my back when I was 20 and it still hurts now. It's not possible.
That's it actually reminds me of I've very recently, well, 10 weeks ago, quit using nicotine. And the book, I did it using this book by Alan Carr.
I know it.
It's like How to Quit Vaping.
Yeah.
And it just, like, it worked. It just, it said, like, you know, follow everything I tell you in this book and it will work. So I was like, right, I'm going to put absolute faith in this book. You know, this is magical thinking, really, isn't it?
Yes.
And it worked.
Sorry to talk about you, but you just pulled the holy shit face. It worked. That's when people get sigils to work. That's the, sorry to cut across. I had to point
that
out.
No, it's fine. It's fine. And I actually did it. Sorry to make this about me.
No, of course. We'll go back to it.
But the fact that I did it through this book, which, although it seemed to be the most kind of, shall we say, basic book, you know, it wasn't like an occult looking kind of cool looking grimoire kind of thing. Yeah. It was very much just like your standard kind of self-help book. But it felt like magic, you know. It's like it's because none of the stuff, you know, it was sort of saying, oh, the cravings, like they only last, you know, they go and stuff like that. And a lot of the stuff, it's just all in your mind. And it's made to feel like it's physical because of seeing people on TV who really need a cigarette, or seeing people on TV who are grumpy because they've not got a cigarette, or hearing other people talk about it. It's a similar principle, I think, isn't it?
It's exactly the same. So something you said there, the book told you the cravings would pass. What they've done is given you a way out. This will end. Just hang on.
Yeah.
Right? And that's another thing with most... Any difficulties people are having are often amplified by the idea that it's going to go on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
Right? And you can do it... So I'll just bring it back to pain very briefly, but it's exactly this. I mean, I do this with smoking. I don't work with smokers that much these days, but one of the things that my supervisor at college told me to do was you get them to time how long it takes for the craving to go away. And you've got data, and then it's got to finish. It's like, this isn't going to keep going.
Yeah.
You've just got to wait a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a similar principle with anxiety, isn't it? Like,
it is.
when you're anxious and when you feel anxious, one of the worst things about it is you start to get anxious about being anxious.
Yeah.
And it's the feeling that it will never go away. And that's the worst part. It's not actually the thing you're anxious about. It's the anxiety that this is me now for the foreseeable future.
Ah, you see, you've adopted an identity.
Yeah.
It's a belief. It's a, this is me rather than this is happening to me or this is a thing that will go away. So there's the belief system. So much of the stuff I'm kind of interested in now is around these placebo effects and nocebo effects. These, you know, the nocebo effect. If I tell you something is really bad, it's like if you're injured, if I sort of say to you, if you bend over further than 90 degrees, you're very likely to injure your back, and you believe me, guess what? You'll bend over 90 degrees and your back will start to hurt. And this is, I mean, I don't know whether you follow Instagram sort of fitness trainers or anything. It's a bad idea to, but there's a load of it out there. Don't move like this. Don't do this. Don't, and, you know? Anyway.
One of the things that you said on the course that I took with you, was it the interesting thing about the placebo effect is that it works.
Yeah.
You know, people say, oh, it's just a placebo. It's just a placebo. Mm. It's not just a placebo.
It's fucking working. Placebo.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, essentially, what we're working with is placebo and nocebo all the time, and it's not. So there's again, this is the misunderstanding of what cultural kind of misunderstanding, I suppose. So none of this is suggesting that injuries don't happen, and if you bang your head on the wall, it's not going to hurt. What it is explaining is that the reason the pain is generated is not why you think it is, and that there are lots of other factors involved in that. Particularly, it's like I got asked by somebody a while ago, like, you know, why does my knee hurt more when I'm in bed at night? And there's a really simple answer. It's dark. And when it's dark, your mood is lower. And also, you've got no other distraction. So if your mood drops and you've got nothing to distract you, your brain generates pain because it thinks, well, it doesn't think anything. It's kind of running a series of, I don't like the word program, but I'll use it anyway. It's kind of drawing conclusions because your mood is low. And also, another question with all of that is, I always ask people, well, is there any time where you're not hurting? Oh yeah, when I'm drawing, you know, I can't feel it. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that you're not paying attention to it. And so, you know, this it is all belief system, even to the point where how sick you get when you get a cold could be, and I think this is probably going to be something that becomes more and more discovered in the next few years. I don't know, let's say next 30 years, something like that. How bad your symptoms are when you are ill is probably part of that process. You know, how physically bad you feel when, you know, because if you're depressed, people get sick more than people who are not depressed, right? So if your mood is low, your body doesn't work properly and it's a nasty downward spiral. And if you, you know, if you expect to get sick for a long time, you probably will. Now that's just my take on this. And I'll give you something concrete to hang on to, and there's something you guys can look up for fun. It's a thing called second year medical student syndrome. Ever heard of it?
No, I haven't.
It's really cool. So in the second year of university is when doctors start studying all the really horrible diseases.
Yeah.
Like the really nasty ones. And they start to develop symptoms. It's really common. Okay. It's really, really common. Because if the brain is bombarded with information about a particular thing, it assumes it might be there. It assumes it might happen. So it starts to produce symptoms.
And do you think this is how sort of when you hear about kind of faith healers and people like that, is that pretty much the same?
Yeah, it could be. I mean,
I guess it's not one or the other, is it? It's something where there's multiple factors tying into it.
It's an interacting system. And I think that so essentially, your psycho, your mood and the social bit of it are much bigger factors than people realize. Definitely in pain, in my opinion, I think probably in illness as well. That's not, you know, you're getting sick for physical reasons, but how bad it is, how long it lasts, how debilitated you are. There's an interesting thing in therapy called underlying secondary gain. So one of the things you look at is, what does this condition give you that you didn't have when you didn't have, when it wasn't there? So if you've got crippling back pain, and every time your back pain comes on, your wife starts doing things for you.
Yeah.
Your unconscious goes, oh, that works.
Yeah.
And very often you don't, nobody knows they're doing it.
Yeah.
It just happens. And I worked with a guy who had similar, so it was back issues and problems with a gag reflex as well. And he asked me about it, and I wasn't sure whether I could help, but I said, well, we'll try. Turned out that gag reflex is part of your autonomic nervous system. And he was just very, very stressed. And we talked about, like, when this happens, do people change their behavior around you? And he said, yeah, my wife starts doing things for me. And I said, okay, next time your back hurts, I'd like you to ask her, just nicely, just say, no, I'm fine. It's kind of a fake it till you make it thing. And his back pain basically disappeared within about 10 days. And then it came back when something happened to upset him. But when that happened, he knew what to do. I think he tweaked it picking up a box when he was moving house. And I talked him through that. And it was a really interesting thing. I said, I want you to close your eyes and focus on where you think the pain is. Okay, and now I want you to put your finger where you think the pain is and press. I said, is there anything there? He's like, no. And then about an inch above it, it was tender. So where he was perceiving the pain wasn't where the tenderness was. So his brain is kind of, it's called referred pain. So you can feel it somewhere else. It's all, you know. So he'd had a tweak. He'd done something small. And then his brain's going, right, don't move, stay still.
Yeah. Do you think, like, it's almost becomes like part of your identity? And do you think, like, when you hear people who say, oh, I never get ill, you know, it's because they know that they are someone who never gets ill?
I think there's something to it.
Yeah.
I'm, if you'll indulge me, I'll explain why I think there's
something
to it.
So, please do.
So I'm very interested in consciousness and a thing called the hard problem of consciousness. So why have you got it? Why have you got it in the first place? I came across it about 4 years ago, listening to by accident, an Australian philosophy professor called David Chalmers, who I believe is at the University of New York, but don't quote me on that. You can find him online. And he's written lots of books about the so-called hard problem. So nobody really knows what consciousness is in the first. There's loads of books about consciousness, but nobody knows what the hell it is. Nobody knows why it's there. What we have is what's called neural correlates. So if we put you in an MRI scanner, we can see bits of your brain light up when you're probably thinking of, but there's no explanation as to why you are experiencing something. So that, and the first time I heard it, I thought, this is either the biggest load of bollocks in the world, or it's the most profound thing I've ever come across. Turns out, fortunately, it was the latter, because it bugged me. And I was just like, is there something to this, or is it nonsense? And that idea of kind of, I started listening to everything Chalmers, all his interviews, and I have also got into, so there's like whole schools of thought around consciousness. And that eventually led me to a guy called Donald Hoffman, who has written a book called The Case Against Reality. So I'm going to hopefully tie in the it's all in your mind thing and go down a massive rabbit hole here. So so Hoffman's thing is, he is a neuroscientist who uses evolutionary game theory. And what he was interested in is why you perceive everything like you do. The studies he did initially came from the Australian jewel beetle. You've probably never heard of this thing, but the long and the short of it is that a beer manufacturer in Australia changed the design of the beer bottles so that the male beetles thought that the beer bottles were females and started mating with them. Right? And because it says here, because when the male Australian jewel beetle searches for a female, it follows very few simple rules. Look for something brown, shiny, and dimpled. So its reality matrix, the rules by which it's seeing anything, seeing the world, obey those rules. Look for something brown, shiny, and dimpled. And the discarded beer bottles had a certain type had those characteristics, and the species was nearly wiped out. Right? And what he discovered was that where he started was that the beetle's perception system evolved to perceive the universe in a particular way that is conducive to its survival.
Yeah.
Okay? You with me so far?
Yeah.
So that's kind of where his kind of hypothesis started. And then at his university, they designed a series of computer programs to test this using evolutionary game theory. Now, I don't know that much about the mathematics of it, but apparently evolutionary game theory can be put into mathematical expression. So they design these algorithms and they create artificial species. And what it turns out is that the artificial species who saw the world as it really was died out really quickly. And the ones who created very strong conceptual constructs didn't. So what is, and this looks like it applies to everything, including us. So what you're seeing, it seems, is the most conducive thing to you surviving. And that is why you see everything like you do. So to take it from that, so that in itself, your mind is creating a construct. Take that one step further. There's Galen Strawson, his name is. He's a British philosopher. He's a philosophy professor, and he's got a really interesting, and I think I talked about this in the workshop.
Yeah.
So I got it as, having looked at consciousness and this idea of consciousness, you come across lots of different schools of thought around it. So you get illusionism, which is guys like Dan Dennett, who think that it's all an illusion anyway. I don't think that can be true, because if it's an illusion, who's looking? And if the observer is a construct of the brain, there's still an observer. So I don't think you can get around that. And kind of the one that really interested me was an idea called panpsychism, which you may have heard of. It's the idea that consciousness is a fundamental property. And I sort of, again, it was one of these things I looked at and went, oh, really? Maybe, maybe not. So most people think about consciousness as being what's called an emergent property. So if you get a complicated enough system, it will become conscious, right? So Roger Penrose, have you heard of him? He wrote A Brief History of Time with Stephen Hawking.
Yeah.
So he is currently sort of working on an idea around consciousness. The hypothesis is that consciousness is not computational, right? And basically the reason he thinks it's not computational, as far as I remember, is because the bit of your brain that has the most densely packed amount of neurons in it appears to be least involved in your conscious activity. So it doesn't seem that complexity and computation have anything to do with it, right? And it would explain why bees appear to be conscious, for example, and their brains are much simpler than ours. So, but from both sides, you've got two problems, right? So if you've got the emergent theory idea, you have what's called the decombination problem. How do you get it out from there, from in here to out there? If you're a panpsychist, you have the combination problem. How does it get out there into here? And so following Hoffman's work, I can't remember the interview I listened to him, but he actually sort of gave me a conclusion to it. So Galen Strawson says that everything is physical. I think everything's physical. And when you get down to subatomic levels, what have you actually got there? If you ask a physicist to describe a particle without using numbers, what are they going to tell you? Have you ever done that?
No.
I have. They're clouds of probability.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right.
So what you're looking at is clouds of so it's a diffusion. The stuff you learn in school isn't right. It's a particle's a diffusion. It's not a thing. That's the really hard bit to get your head around. It's not a thing. It's a cloud of probability with a lot of space in it. So what are you actually looking at when you sort of, you know, touch something? The reason I can't put my finger through the phone is because the forces repel each other. the phone is mostly space. So why do I look at it like I do? So Strawson basically follows that with, well, the particles are consciousness. So everything is consciousness. So there's no separating the two.
That sounds almost like a kind of science-based animism almost. The idea that everything, you know, your phone has a spirit, a rock has a spirit, a tree has a spirit. But instead of spirit here, we're using the term consciousness, you know, like...
Ah, yes and no, because that's a dualistic position. And panpsychism, like the phone doesn't have consciousness in it. The phone is consciousness.
So everything around you, including you, is part of this...
Including you.
Is part of this one sort of varying cloud of probability.
Yep.
Wow.
And Hoffman's... Now, again, this is just... Right, so this is unprovable. It just makes sense to me at the moment, right? And I think it's quite a... It's a cool idea, and it kind of knits a lot of things together. And if you ask me again in 2 years, I might change my mind. But at the moment, this kind of hangs together nicely. And I listened to an interview with Hoffman where he was talking about these experiments and, like, why you see everything like you do. And then they sort of pushed him a little bit about what he thought... was actually happening, where he thought the conclusion was. And he's now started to work, I think he might have completed the first paper on it. So he's working on a mathematical proof of consciousness, but he's working backwards. He's assuming that consciousness is everywhere. And he's got to make it work it back and make it fit with physics. So this is really quite out there stuff, but you know, these aren't like drug taking hippies saying this. These are like top level.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying it's right, but and there's a lot of people looking at that. And in his thing, I'll try and describe it basically, is that what you have is an interacting system of consciousness. Your mind, when you take in information, that alters your brain, which changes your thoughts, which alters what's going on outside because it changes your behavior. So it's this constant feedback loop. There is no, I'm going to sound like a massive hippie now. There is no separateness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, to me, really neatly explains, without the need for any MacGuffins or workarounds or faith or anything like that, pretty much everything, I think. So that's kind of why I've landed there. And it's sort of how I can work with spirits in an occult context. I don't need the spirit to be a real separate thing. I just need to believe it hard enough because it's an interacting feedback system and the universe will respond accordingly. There's a thing called assembly theory, and it's more like a science show, isn't it, rather than that.
This is great. I'm loving it.
This is exactly at Muckley's Street. This is the sort of thing that I hoped we'd get into.
Cool. So assembly theory was, who's it developed by? It was developed by Leroy Cronin, who's a professor of mathematics at Glasgow University, and Sarah Imari Walker, who's a physicist in Arizona State. And it's basically designed to, attempts to identify extraterrestrial life, right, by assigning complexity algorithms to things. Now, the thing I'm going to suggest you listen to, do you know Lex Fridman? You
heard of him? Heard of, yeah.
Yeah, right, they do an interview with him. It's 3.5 hours. Go and listen to it. It'll blow your brains out. Because the conclusions that they were drawing are astounding. about the way the universe works. So one of the conclusions that Leroy Cronin was talking a lot about, this idea that the universe appears to act as though it has a mind. So, and the other thing they were talking about was free will. So like this kind of argument around free will goes, and they came up with something I thought was really elegant, that nods towards the idea that you may well have free will, is the fact that you can think of something novel that's never existed before. And it fits inside assembly theory. So go and check that out and, you know.
Yeah, I will.
Come back to me and tell me what you think, because I don't know enough people who've listened to it to talk. But it blew my brains out. I was sitting there, I listened to it three times.
And where was it? Is it like on YouTube or something? Or?
I just got it on Apple Podcasts. But if
it's a podcast, right.
Yeah, Lex Fridman, Assembly Theory. And I thought, well, this would be interesting. It's about extraterrestrial life. And the stuff they go into is crazy. Really, like, and it fits with all this, you know, with all these other things. So, yeah, there you go.
This is really, really fascinating.
It's all a dream. It's all a dream.
How do you think that fits with, like, simulation theory? Because that sounds very similar to that as well, in a way, doesn't it? And do you think it's just, that's just like a... us interpreting that as simulation because that's the kind of height of our technology at the moment, so we can't think beyond the idea of something being a simulation. But
David Chalmers does a lot of work on simulation theory, and if you're into this, you love it. So my one of the things that he talks about that I found very interesting was this idea. So it's the Matrix idea, right? That if this is a simulation, it's not real. And so what he says is that's not true. It's just a different type of real. Instead of particles and electrons, you've got digital information and binary that you're interpreting. So what's the difference? I meant to say this earlier. There's a really good metaphor to explain Hoffman's kind of underlying idea, I suppose. So like when you use a computer like we're doing now, you're not seeing what's really happening in the computer.
No.
Right? You're seeing an interpretation from the screen that's taken into your brain and translated into something you can understand, right? So my face, lovely as it is an icon that your mind can recognize, that your consciousness can translate so you can interact with my consciousness. That's how he thinks. And I thought that was very elegant way of describing it, really neat. Because actually, if you think about it, if you had to interact with the computer in the way that it's quote-unquote really working, you wouldn't be able to do anything.
Yeah, it's like an avatar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it could, because underneath you've got a bunch of electrical signals flying up and down that you can't see that then translate into something else.
And then that kind of fits also with like ultra-terrestrial theory as well, the idea that they appear to us as things which we recognize almost like that fit with our culture or fit with our mythology, because that's our only way of interpreting it. And so our consciousness creates this, like you say, avatar icon that looks like a gray alien or whatever, because that's what we're, that's what our culture has, sort of thing. Yeah, I know what I mean.
I understand. I agree. And it's also why, like, you get, so to take it back to the occult, it's why you get tropes within the occult.
Yeah.
You know, because, and because you, so you operate within a sort of, like a self-referencing system. You know, there's a reason stereotypes exist, because they're useful. If you didn't have them, you know, you wouldn't be able to navigate. You take that out of the equation, you can't navigate anymore. So it's kind of, you know, this sort of the modern idea of identity and those things fascinates me as well, because I've never known how people identify as anything, to be honest. I don't know how you begin to do that. I don't know where you start, you know. But I do know that sort of messing with the construct has consequences, you know. And one of the things we're doing with chaos magic is messing with the construct.
Yeah.
You know, if you change, so for example, really simple one, take the verb to be out of your day-to-day language. See if you can talk very easily. You're going to have a lot of trouble communicating.
Was that's similar to the Robert Anton Wilson one, isn't it? Where he,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I love, love Robert Anton Wilson. See, I can't even say it without is.
Yeah, yeah, he took his out, yeah, didn't he? Yeah.
It's his least favourite word. It's yeah, a meaningless word. And I had his book right where you're sitting. That is where it started. You just reminded me. There we are. That's where I started. His book right where you're sitting now.
Right.
And it blew my brains out.
Interestingly enough, that's actually the name of a podcast that we were going to give a shout out to tonight, because a good podcast by that very name. There's a guy called Ken, and he's been quite kind and helpful in his information and book recommendations. So shout out to Ken. Sorry, back to Robert Anton Wilson.
No, that's fine. I mean, if he's named his podcast after that book was life changing for me.
Yeah,
because when he talks about reality labyrinths,
yeah,
you are stuck in a stuck is the wrong word, because you know they're necessary. You have to. You can't navigate otherwise.
Yeah,
you know, you start taking it apart too much, and it falls to bits. This is why people who take too many hallucinogenic drugs go a bit weird.
Yeah,
because you start to see, I'm not going to say what's really there, but you see a different version of what you're used to. And if you do that too much, you can't navigate like everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See? So all of these things are...
You get that with some magicians as well, you know, that they've basically almost detached themselves from reality or almost sort of instigated a form of psychosis within themselves that they can't get back from, because obviously magic is, to an extent... particularly the way I think that you're looking at it, is sort of inducing an alternative state within the mind. And I think, like with the hallucinogens, if people do it enough, then they start to lose track of what's real and what isn't.
I think my take on most things actually is it useful? I'm not I find it gets me out of a lot of scrapes, actually. I'm not sort of a fan of kind of moralistic positions, anything like that, because, you know, pretty much everything in the human mind is flexible to some degree or another. The question I always ask is it useful? Mostly in the context of, is it getting me what I want? Which actually, so that comes back to the Satanist thing, right? So the reason I like LaVey, and I'm not a sort of full-blown kind of believer. I'm too kind of flexible for that. But one of the things, sort of one of the problems, okay, so this is just my opinion at this point, rather than the hard facts I've been giving you so far. So one of the problems of the way that kids are taught to interact with each other is that they're taught to put other people first all the time. Right. Something I noticed when I started working and training as a therapist is the thing you do with someone who is vulnerable is you teach them to put themselves first. Fix yourself first, then fix other people. And you're kind of told the opposite for a very long time. And there's kind of this social idea that you should pick other people up all the time. Everybody else should come first. And I don't think it's a good idea. I think if I sort myself out, I'll be in a much better position to help you. And if you understand that you've got to sort yourself out, you're more likely to ask me for help.
That's like the idea on an aeroplane, you know, you get your own mask first and then help everyone else's. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that... So, believe it or not, a lot of this comes from business networking again. So, one of the sayings of one of the groups I used to belong to is give as gain, right? And what it means is if I do you a favor, you will want to do me one back. Turns out you just won't want to. You're genetically wired to do so, right? So, helping people and just kind of interacting with people and not being a dick gets me more stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I can be selfish and everybody benefits. Does that make sense? That's how I look at it. Whereas if I prostrate myself and I then end up resenting you, you know, and that's an extreme example. But so I generally view most things from, is this beneficial? Is this what I really want to do? Is it a good idea? And I proceed from there, you know, because then that's why I have a coach. My coach's entire job is to take my mess of ideas. I have lists of stuff and he helps me prioritize them. You know, what do I actually want to do? I have to have finite things. I can't work on endless projects. I have to have, and it's got to have a time limit to it. I figured this out ages ago with like, I was looking at like, why do I lift weights every week, but I avoid practicing drums? Because the weights have numbers attached to them. My brain likes numbers. So I've got to, it's got to be, it's the same thing with the craving will pass. This has an ending to it. I have done a thing. I can tick it off, you know, and that sort of, I think that's a useful thing to understand for yourself. Like what are your underlying drivers? What makes you do things? And then it's easier to pick what you want to do versus what you would, in, and not get in the quagmire of spinning your wheels and doing things you don't really want to do. There you go, solved your whole life for you.
Yeah.
If only it was that easy.
I love what you've talked about. It reflects, I mean, obviously you've got the science and the philosophy that's been in there, but also neuro-linguistic programming, cognitive behavioral therapy, some of this is reflected in that. What I noticed when I was taking your course is that you seem to almost unify all this into your magical practice in a way. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, yes, but it might not make sense. one of the reasons, so the coach I'm working with at the moment, I'm a big believer in coaching, in case you hadn't guessed at this point, but the guy I've worked with, his name is Andrew Horder, and his company's called Joyful Genius, which sounds incredibly naff, but well, he's very, very good, but he's brilliant. He's really, really good. His whole thing is figuring out what your underlying driver is. And I did a workshop with him a long, long time ago, because I was a bit lost. I didn't really know what I was doing. And what you had to do in the work, so it's a business thing, but it's all the same anyway. You had to take along four testimonials that someone else had said about you. And then you had to write down in the workshop what you thought you brought to the table. And then you put them in two columns and you join the dots. And it turns out that the universal thing that I'm good at is making difficult things look easy. Mastery through simplicity. That's my mantra, right? So what I try and do is show you how you can get there and how easy it is and what's distracting you. And that goes through every single thing I do. And this is, you know, it's why I work with the guy again and again and again, because suddenly that was a big moment. It was like, shit, that's what I do, isn't it? That is what I do all the time. When I'm teaching chaos magic, what I'm hoping is that people come out and they get it, and they get something about it that go away with, right? That you can, even if you just know how to make a sigil or you understand, I think the most important bit is understanding what you want underneath. When you're playing drums, the first question I ask is, who do you want to be like? Who do you want to play like? So it gives you a target. You've got a thing to aim at all the time. And it makes these impossible sounding things feel easy. If they feel easy, guess what? it's changing belief systems all the time. And that's kind of how it ties in. And it's the same thing in therapy. We're like, what am I doing? I'm trying to take these very tricky, stressful, difficult problems and boil them down to something simple. So you've got a way out. All I've got to do is open the door and show, look, you just got to go that way. I don't want to open the door. I want to show you where it is and you go and open it. I talk about this in the. Do you remember the mammoth in the mammoth in the pen, right? So if the mammoth, I should probably explain what the mammoth is before I go on.
Yeah.
So in the Sigil Secret, the model I use is a rider and a mammoth. So the rider is you, your frontal lobe. the person you consider yourself, the rational, logical, planning bit of you. Behind that is your mammoth. So you're riding on top of this giant ancient elephant, and that's your limbic system. So in Steve Peters' book, The Chimp Paradox, it's the chimp and the human. The reason I used the mammoth is because I wanted to convey the massive power of the unconscious and the fact that it's taking you for a ride most of the time. So when the mammoth panics, a lot of the time what happens is the rider punishes the mammoth for panicking. And a metaphorical way of thinking of it is if you've got the mammoth penned in to like a giant enclosure and it's stressed and panicking, one of the best things you can do is just open the gate and move out of the way. You just got to let it run. So in a day-to-day situation, if somebody has like panic attacks, and they have panic attacks in particular situations, like they get on a bus, it's quite a common one actually, public transport, because there's loads of people. One of the things I say to them is, well, okay, I teach them panic breathing so they can control it. And then I say, well, look, what are you going to do if you start to have a panic attack and it gets a bit much? Oh, I don't know. Okay, get off the bus. And most of the time, they haven't thought about it. So they're so busy fixating on how bad the panic attack's going to be, they haven't thought of the simple solution. And that's nothing to do with intelligence, right? When the mammoth is panicking, it takes over. And all I've done is given them permission to open the pen. Get off the bus, just get out of the situation. You don't have to be there. And a lot of times people will do that and they'll come back and go, oh yeah, no, I got off. And then I got on again and it was all right. And then the next time they don't need to get off because they know they can. And so it's a belief system again. I can get out of this if I want to. And then it calms down.
Talking about the mammoth and the rider and the sigil secret, when people used to ask me, you know, that they used to say that they wanted to start practicing magic straight away, you know, if they really had to start practicing magic that second, mm-hmm. I used to suggest to them Pop Magic by Grant Morrison, in which he sets out a fairly simple system of sigilization.
Yeah.
Now, if someone asks me, I point them to thechaoschamber.com, which is your website, amongst which there are many videos which first of all show you how to do sigils. They show you in a way how to formulate your intentions, and it also connects to some of this chronic pain thing you were talking about. There's loads of really good stuff there. I'd recommend it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I launched a shoal of sigils last full moon, and out of 15, 10 of them were ones from the Chaos Chamber. Yeah, I really like the ideas that you do some fantastic sigils for starters, really. And I was hoping that you could, for the people amongst our listeners who haven't got a magical practice and have never tried sigils, I was wondering if you could maybe give a sort of brief overview, a little taster of your book, and sort of how they can basically start their magical practice as soon as they finish listening to this podcast.
Oh, okay. So this is all going to be auditory, I assume. No,
yes. Yeah. We can't do video at the moment.
Brilliant. This is going to show how much I know, isn't it? So, so how to make a sigil from scratch. So the first thing I would say is lose your expectations of what it means to be a magician. Okay. So as soon as you've done your first sigil, you're in. There's no levels. There's no, you know, unless you join an organized religious group, everything's up for grabs. So to make a sigil is actually really simple. And the first sigil you should make is My Sigils Work. Obviously. And the second sigil you should make is I Forget My Sigils. Right, so I'll explain why you make the second one. What the sigil does is it allows you a way of giving an instruction or a strong suggestion to your unconscious. Right. So the idea behind them, as I understand it, is that your unconscious, your limbic system, the mammoth, is the bit that does the magic. Right. So it's the bit that's kind of controlling your behaviors in your environment underneath. It doesn't read or write. It can't understand words. It works purely in emotion. So, but it does understand symbols. It's why it responds to things like advertising, right? You have emotional responses to imagery. So by taking a written statement and turning it into an image, you have something that the rider can't understand, so it can't question it. So the rational bit of your brain is the bit that says, oh, can I really do this? But the mammoth recognizes and infers the meaning of, so it can act upon it. So what you do is you would write that sigil out, and that's the first one, my sigils work. It's S-I-G-I-L. And the first thing you do is you take out all the vowels. The practical reason for doing that is you shrink the amount of letters you're using. The historical reason, as far as I am aware, is that some of the first sigils were in Hebrew, and a lot of magic done in the West is based on Kabbalah and things like that. It comes from pretty much everything everybody does comes from Crowley, basically. So it's based on that at some point, except chaos magic. you take all the vowels out, and then you take all the duplicate letters out. And the remaining consonants that you're left with, you make an image. And you freehand the image, so you join them together. It's best if you go to the Chaos Chamber and just watch one of my videos are really short. Just watch one of them.
Yeah, we'll link to those in the show notes.
Yeah. And when you have that sigil, you then charge it. Now, I'm assuming this isn't a show for kids, so I'm going to explain the simplest charging method. you can tell...
Charge away.
Chaos magic was invented by men, because what you do is you bring yourself to orgasm while you're staring at the sigil. Same for men and women. The idea being, the logic behind it is that when you are in an orgasmic state, you cannot think. And so the rider is off somewhere having fun, and the sigil goes straight through into the mammoth. And the mammoth acts upon it. And you then take the sigil and destroy it. I usually burn them. You don't throw it in the bin. So you want to destroy it in an appropriate fashion. Right? So do something fancy. Put it in some running water. You know, don't just chuck it away or keep it on you. But normally you want to destroy it, and you want to then not think about the outcome. Now, here's the thing. It's not such a problem with my sigils work, because it's the only one you've done, so you won't know till you do some more. when you do the second sigil, I forget my sigils. That will help with that process. So they're the first two I would do, and that's hopefully a reasonably clear explanation of how to do it. And then I just wanted to tell you something really quickly. On the videos on my website, the most popular one is how to win the lottery using sigil magic. somebody asked me on, I did a video about something else, and they said, oh, can you do one about winning the lottery? I'm like, yeah, sure. And the answer is basically don't bother. Like, it won't work, because you're nudging probability all the time. That's all you're doing, right? So even Peter Carroll talks about this in Liber Chaos, in slightly more sort of complex terms. But so even if you nudge probability teeny little bit, it's probably not, the odds against you winning the lottery are so enormous that even if the sigil works, it won't make any difference. So another way I sort of explain this is you're a magician, you're not performing miracles. It's different. Magic is the act of nudging. You're just bumping things, you're lining the dominoes up slowly. And also, it tends to have more of an effect if you remember that and do small things. So if you want to try financial magic, pennies on the ground. That's a good one to start with.
I've watched quite a few of your videos on your YouTube, and you seem to keep your the intentions that you write down to turn into sigils, keep them very brief.
Yeah.
So obviously that kind of leads to a more focused idea, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. But my worry would be if I did something like that. So say if this doesn't really apply to me, but say if someone did a sigil, mm-hmm. I lose weight because they wanted to lose weight.
Yeah.
What's to say that they wouldn't get horribly ill?
You're going with this, yeah.
Okay. You know, and it's like, is there yeah. a... What's your take on that? What do you think?
Okay, so The short version is, if you think that's going to happen, it probably will.
Okay.
Right. So, but there's some ways around it, right? Interestingly enough, I had a mate of mine who uses a lot of goetic magic. It's like demon summoning. And so to me, it's all the same thing, right? Because you use a sigil to summon a demon, blah, blah, blah. And he said every time he used the Goetia, he'd get what he wanted, but there would be horrible unintended consequences around it. And I think that's, see, in my model, that's the belief system around what the Goetia really means, you see. Whereas if he was using angels to do it, that probably wouldn't happen. In the most appropriate way for me is a really good catch-all statement, right? I lose weight in the most appropriate way for me. So if, you know, I lose weight in the safest way for me. I mean, you've got to think of, but some version of that, I lose weight in the way that is best for me.
Yeah, there's in your book, I think you use quite a lot, which I've started using, is in the way that I need to.
There you go. Yeah. Okay, that one. It's some variation of that. And also, if you don't know, I receive that which I need the most right now. That's actually a hypnosis suggestion. Like if you're doing with just a general kind of working with anxiety, or like your unconscious will tell you the thing you need to know the most right now. Because my whole thing is, it knows better than you. You're just an annoying interference most of the time that just gets in the way. It already knows what it's going to do. It knows how to do it. It needs your help sometimes. The rider is there for planning and sort of rational laying out of things, but execution of things, you just, you know, we get in the way.
There about hypnotism, and obviously you're a hypnotherapist as well. Mm-hmm. What came first? Was it magic or hypnotism to you?
The occult first.
And then you went from there to become a hypnotherapist?
Yeah, a long time after. So I came across hypnosis by accident, actually. It's 2008 was when I started training. And it was the mother of one of my drum students, and I was talking to her about a phobia that I had, and I had some treatment for it. And it turned out that the sort of, this is going to sound a really odd thing to say, but I kind of unwittingly had a quite a bad depression problem for a long time, since I was a kid. So this all kind of ties in together, and one of the reasons I think I'm able to do what I do is because I know what it's like from the inside. So I've had chronic pain. And it's not, you know, you don't need to know it, but if somebody comes to me and I said, well, look, I get it. I know what it's like when somebody's depressed and you talk about being in the hole, when you just don't feel anything, you know, if you've, it builds rapport. It's not necessary, but I kind of think that helps me do what I do. I'm fine now, by the way. okay, so we've been clear quite a long time, but she gave me the hypnosis treatment. I was like, oh, that was interesting. And I asked her about where she trained, and she introduced me to a lady called Maggie Chapman, who was the principal of the London College of Clinical Hypnosis, who became my supervisor. Maggie's an excellent therapist, works with all kinds of things, particularly like really serious self-harm. I went and did a 4-week introduction, and that was it. I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, and I'd got a bit bored with, well, I'd overloaded myself with teaching and kind of didn't know where I was going. And the bands I was in had split, and I thought I needed to do something new. And it's just weird enough for me, basically. It's right on the cusp of practical and weird. I don't like to go too far, you know. I like to sort of, you know, kind of walk this tightrope down the middle, so it can't be too banal. I mean, you know, I play music, but the music I like is, you know, really sort of extreme heavy stuff or instrumental jazz fusion. I don't like, you know, I like pop and things like that. But anyway, so I did that, and then I signed up for their, I borrowed some money and I did a diploma. I did a year course. So, and they were very, very good. Because it was taught by therapists. Second best thing I ever did, but first best thing was leaving UCL and going to music school. And then, actually, do you know what? That's twice I've gone to private institutions to learn what I wanted to do. And twice it's been the best decision I've ever made, you know? And I kind of looked at, I'm doing some more sort of music education stuff at the moment and spoke to some people about doing a BA or a master's. And my friend's a lecturer at Leeds University. And he said, I've been playing like 30 years. And he said, don't do the BA, it'd be too easy. You could do the master's. It's 12 grand. And then I sat down and I thought, again, this like, what do I really want here? What am I actually, I'm doing it for sort of the sake of achievement. You know, just cause. And how many private lessons could I get for 12 grand from the best teachers in the world? You know, I could fly to Los Angeles and, because I know drumming's reasonably tight-knit community, so I know how to, you know, I know a lot of these guys. So even an expensive top-level drummer's $150 an hour.
Yeah.
How many hours could I get for that? You know, and it's like, So I've branched off into complaining about education now, but it's both times, I think, you know, I'd suddenly realised that both times I've sort of done the things that have given me the most benefit, I've had to find somewhere else to do it, if you see what I mean.
And both things seem to have fed into your practice as well. I really liked the way that the hypnotism stuff came into the course that I did with you. There was actually a bit where you had us all in a trance. And you actually said something interesting that I was going to ask you about at that point.
just one interesting thing.
Something particularly that I grabbed onto, but I didn't want to talk about in the class because it would have just taken us all off the thing, which was that mentioned about putting us into the trance, you said that a few of the different things that you could feel, you said there's could be a feeling of disassociation, there could be a feeling of limbs being somehow separate in a way from your body. You said you could get pins and needles, and you said you could get distortion of time. At the time, all that I thought reminded me a bit of what some people say when they have an alien abduction. It's a very similar sort of thing. And then I started to think about other phenomena that was connected, like the steady rhythmic drumming in shamanic journeying or spirit dance, or the concentration on the rhythmic breathing in meditation, or the long and repetitive litanies and incantations from ritual magic. And even the structure and the force sitting, standing, joined prayer and singing within the Catholic Mass, for example, all indicated to me something similar, you know, this perhaps a form of self-hypnosis or group hypnosis as an efficient form of information transfer or a convenient way of accessing other forms of consciousness. And that made me think maybe, and it's not an original thought of mine. I've read it in other places, and I've heard on the Willow Truman and Sequoia Kennedy on the Nonsense Bazaar have been talking about something similar. But maybe hypnotism is, or self-hypnosis or induced trance is more common to all of these occult phenomena, or some sort of unifying factor between them all in a way that a lot of people don't realize.
Yeah. Did I talk? I didn't talk about this on the
course. No, I don't think so.
No. So I have, I do a course about making servitors, magical servitors. And I talk about the unifying factors of magical practice, and I'll see if I can remember them all, but auto-hypnosis is one of them. Like every single, you know, spiritualist do it, you know, like the OTO do it, Wiccans do it, meditation, some kind of you know, I don't like the term altered state, but some kind of hypnosis you have, and you all of them have some kind of repetitive motion or sound. There is a strong kind of cross connection between all of these things. And they all come back to the same thing, that what you're doing is things that either calm the mammoth or put the rider to sleep so the mammoth can come forth, basically. That's kind of the connecting threads between all of them. Like, all magic practice is basically the same thing, you know, including Catholic mass, funerals, and animals do it as well. Crows have funerals. So, you know, this is not a human thing. There's something about it. And again, this ties really neatly back, actually, to where we kind of opened up, as it goes, because one of the sort of paradoxes that people have mentioned about how I work is I work with spirits, but I don't necessarily believe in them.
Yeah.
Right? But I accept that a bit of my brain probably does. Right? Because I use the two systems model, and I'm cool with that. Like, you know, there's an irrational bit of my brain that thinks that there's fairies at the bottom of the garden, and I'm quite happy to engage that. And so that's sort of how you can hold, you know, a dualistic position on it.
And that's chaos magic, isn't it? Adopt the belief system that will serve you best at the time.
Yeah. Does it work?
It's one of the things that I was talking to you a little bit about when I did the course, and I wanted to get a little bit more into before we finished tonight. Okay. Is you mentioned that you do spirit work, and you mentioned that sort of paradox that you believe in this physical model, but a lot of the magic that you do, or some of the magic that you do, involves spirit work. And I actually watched a full talk that you did recently with a medium where you compared notes on spirits. But you don't have to fit it into any particular model or anything like that. I mean, I'm not sort of trying to catch you out at all. I'd just like to get your take on what spirits are and how you use them.
Okay. I can give you two answers. So one of the answers is I don't care what they are as long as I get the result, right? That's the short one, okay? So if I do a ritual and it gets me the thing, I don't care why the thing is there. So that's answer one. Answer two, so the consciousness model I was talking about earlier, that idea in my way of thinking allows for, so they don't need to be an externality, I just need to believe that they are there hard enough, and they will be. It's why people see ghosts at night in graveyards, that sort of thing. So because, as you probably guessed, my version of kind of what is real and what isn't has become somewhat, that makes me sound ill, doesn't it? My version of what is real is blurred somewhat.
In that hole myself.
So my kind of position on reality, quote unquote, is somewhat different. My wife actually says the more you sort of look into the science side of it, the more woo you become. It's true, you know, because there's a lot of crossover. So I don't think, right, so I can allow for the existence of such a thing without needing it to be separate to anything physical. So they would be conscious things without a body, I suppose. But I don't discount, I don't see that. So if this is consciousness, I don't discount that there could be like discrete pockets of consciousness that don't need physical interfaces. There you go. Something like that. Cool. That's clever, isn't it? Or is it? I don't know. Yeah, does that make sense? So it kind of fits in that model. It works quite neatly for me.
One thing that you were saying about your idea when you were talking about Hoffman and his work, and you were saying about all of reality being basically delocalized probability, or consciousness being everything, and that being reality, all being delocalized probability. And then when you were describing chaos magic and sigils, you were talking about nudging probability to get a particular result. So do you see that as being, you know, chaos magic as being a way of reaching out and altering reality by sort of pushing the probability which actually makes up everything in certain ways? Or Do you not see it that broadly?
Yes, but I reach inwards to change it, not outwards.
Right, okay.
So I'm changing here to change. So I'm not doing that. I'm never pushing against it. I'm altering. Right. So I see my brain as a receiver rather than a generator. So what I'm doing is retuning it to receive something slightly different. That's kind of how I look at it. If I retune it, so this might turn into a crap metaphor, so strap in. But if I retune it too quickly, I might just end up with static. I suppose you've got, you're familiar with the many worlds hypothesis?
Yeah.
Or
the Everett.
Hugh Everett.
Yeah.
Right, so I don't know that much about it, but it kind of, one way you could think about it is like in any situation, you've got sort of like four probability pathways you can go, right? So what the sigil does is help my mind adjust pathways. Put it like that. Does that make sense? So it kind of, I'm adjusting the lens or the thing I'm adjusting the focus. That's a simpler way of putting it. What sigils actually do is make you recognize opportunities that you wouldn't have otherwise noticed, right? So they focus your consciousness on the thing it needs to be focused on. I talked about the reticular activating system, but there's a bit of your brain that filters out information, and sigils are really good for pointing at things that it needs to notice. So that's a really sort of mechanical way of thinking about it. But I do think that I am changing reality by doing that. There you go. Stuck my neck out. But I do, you know, but I think that everybody's doing it all the time. I've had some weird conversations since I've got into all of this stuff, and sort of started talking to people about psilocybin research, and I don't know how familiar you are with where that, because there's a lot of research into that for mental health and things.
Yeah.
But the idea of sort of certain types of dreams that people have, I'm kind of really open to the possibility that your mind is dimension hopping, that you're kind of jumping between realities isn't the right way of putting it, that you are sort of, I think your mind can probably observe alternate probability pathways that you're not traveling on at the moment. So
wow.
Yeah, I don't know, like, but it's certainly something. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I said no chance, but now I'm kind of okay, maybe, you know, because if it's all consciousness and many worlds is the right one, which I'm not that familiar with it, but that would kind of hang together as well. So I just spend my entire life looking for ideas that kind of hang together and just go with them, you know. So.
Oh, that's really, really interesting, because that's something also that Alan Greenfield was talking about, wasn't it?
He said quantum physics is insane, I think was his...
Mm. Yeah. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. I think that our brains... So I think we will understand it, but not yet. And one of the things... Sorry, this goes back to something else. One of the things Hoffman was talking about in... I can't remember what the interview was, but he talked about illness. And his personal, and it's just his personal opinion, it's not based on anything other than, but he thinks we will evolve to be able to think ourselves better. You will actually be able to physically, because you already can to a limited degree affect your body by changing what you think. As we talked about earlier, you know, your mood states affect. And he thinks it will go further than that. And I think it's worth kind of, at least taking, to borrow David Chalmers' phrase, it's worth taking seriously. It's worth kind of looking into. I don't think we're there yet, though. But I think that will be what we evolve kind of towards. And the interesting thing will be that comes out of it is whether that will happen because people start believing it's going to.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, that would be really like, I don't know how you'd know, but, you know, if people start believing it, if you believe. Well, it's like when world records are broken. You know, the reason they get broken and then broken again and broken again and broken again and broken again is wasn't because people weren't physically capable. They just saw that someone else did it and, you know.
Yeah,
it makes you wonder what's happened previously, like how much of human progress has actually happened because we've believed it.
Yeah. That's a whole nother podcast. That's a long. Yeah. Well, there was a. And now I'm going to. The caveat with this very short quip, I can't remember the exact details of it, but I seem to remember something about sheep. And on one side of the world, this woman observed a sheep falling on its side. And it's a behavior that had never been observed in sheep before. And then all of them started doing it. And then about a year later, sheep on the other side of the world started doing it. So they started kind of learning this new... That's a really bad explanation.
There's a theory called the 100th monkey, isn't there?
Okay.
The 100th monkey. And that was when it was... It was actually from like an apocryphal story where someone had been observing behavior within monkeys on an island. Mm-hmm. And then the idea was that when they all exhibited this behavior, that when it got to the 100th monkey, the behavior went to all monkeys, not just the monkeys on that island.
That's right. Yeah.
But
that's
all it. Monkeys that, everywhere.
That's
yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of
it's the fucking placebo effect.
Well, it's weird is what it is. And there's another one that I've just remembered. It's probably better, slightly. You've rescued my example there, but towards the end of the 1800s, there was an epidemic of fainting amongst young women. Yeah. Right? And it sort of disappeared over time and got replaced. So you have these kind of cultural isms that sort of manifest as physical ailments, if you like. Migraines is one of them. So this is this kind of a new phenomenon, you know. And again, it's this idea that because you're seeing other people have it, you get it. The nocebo effect, you know.
Where can people find you on the internet at Treadwells and all the rest of all the different places?
Okay, so the chaoschamber.com is my chaos magic website. And there's a website called thesigilsecret.com, which is my publisher's put together. It's got some freebie things on there and just some previews of the book. My drumming website is drumgnosis.com. Drumgnosis as hypnosis and drums put together. I'm on Instagram and Facebook, but Facebook's just a personal thing. Instagram is mostly drumming. I don't really have my YouTube channel. It's called The Chaos Chamber, so that's the only social media I do for that. That's where I am, and I'm nowhere near Twitter, thank God.
Yeah. It's a war zone at the moment.
Don't like it's always been a war zone. It's just poison. So.
That's amazing. Well, thanks very, very much for joining us tonight, Mark. It's been absolutely incredible. And it's really been it's taken us in some directions that we've never been on this podcast. So that's been absolutely fantastic.
It was a really good conversation and I learned a lot. I've made a lot of notes that I can't read, so I'll just have to read the show notes when the podcast is released.
I would love to come back at some point if you have me. So this has been really fun.
So I was going to ask Mark before you go.
Yeah.
Do you know any good drummer jokes?
Oh God. Yes, I do. Let me see if I can remember them.
Would you like to tell one? Would you like to share one? Or
I'd love to share.
We like to lighten things up at the end. You know, just as like a banishing.
Would you call a guy who hangs around with musicians a drummer? There you go.